All right, we are back. And as promised, we're going to have a very interesting discussion with UC Davis microbiologist Dr. Mark Wheelis. Dr. Wheelis received a PhD in bacteriology from UC Berkeley in 1969 and did postdoctoral research in biochemistry at the University of Illinois. He has been affiliated with UCD from 1970 to the present and is a senior lecturer in microbiology. Dr. Wheelis is also director of the program in Nature and Culture. He's authored numerous pieces on the history of biological warfare and the control of biological weapons, including two chapters on biological warfare in Biological and Toxin Weapons, Research, Development, and the Use from the Middle Ages to 1945. Dr. Wheelis has contributed to the Federation of American Scientists Working Group on Biological Weapons and has frequently been consulted by the media. And today, that's us. We're very pleased to have a genuine expert in infectious disease and biological weapons on the program. Dr. Wheelis, welcome to Radio Parallax. I gather that biological weapons are nothing new.
Nope, not at all. They've been around probably since the dawn of history. The earliest clearly documented cases that I've been able to find date to the 14th century, when biological material of various kinds were catapulted into besieged cities. Probably the most famous incident was in 1348, when an outbreak of plague hit the besiegers of the Italian trading outpost of Caffa in the Crimea on the Black Sea. And before they abandoned the siege, the Mongol armies that were besieging the city used their catapults to hurl their plague dead into the city. That probably was responsible for starting an outbreak of plague in the city of Caffa, and then merchants fleeing from Caffa back to Europe were at least one of the several routes that plague reached Europe and then began the major outbreak that we now know as the Black Death.
One of the great pandemics of Black Death.
It was the second major pandemic of plague. The first was earlier, the plague of Justinian, and the third is a somewhat less spectacular pandemic that began early in this century and affected mainly India, China, Manchuria, that area, although it has spread worldwide.
So it's clear from very early on that bioweapons, once used, are a bit hard to control.
To the extent that the Black Death was partially the result of a biological attack in the Crimea, it was certainly spectacularly successful as a means of transmitting disease. It's also certain that at least on a few occasions, British colonists and military types made attempts to transmit smallpox to Native Americans in the New World. And there's one well-documented case at Fort Pitt in 1763. There was, and smallpox was an exceedingly lethal disease for Native Americans. Many outbreaks killed somewhere between 75% and 90% of the patients infected, and the attack rate was very high as well. We have not been able to document conclusively that any particular outbreak among Native Americans was the result of an actual biological attack, but I think it's probable that that did happen. We have been able to document conclusively at least one such attack, and there is evidence that there were others as well.
We tend to associate bioterrorism with human diseases, but it's also applicable to attacks upon livestock and agriculture, is it not?
Yes. There's no well-documented example of this having been done for sure, but it's certainly something that people have been aware of for some time. With regard to the agricultural sector, the goals would be probably economic, at least in the modern world. It would probably be very, very difficult, for most countries at least, to mount an attack on agriculture whose result was to actually cause massive starvation among the people because of reduction in food supply. But because of the immense amount of money that changes hands in the trade in agricultural commodities, it is possible to do a tremendous amount of economic damage. It's been estimated, for example, that an outbreak of foot and mouth disease in California would cost something on the order of $10 to $20 billion worth of damage, even if the outbreak was confined to California and eradicated within a couple of months. So those kinds of levels of economic damage are plausible in an attack on agriculture, and that has made a number of people think that perhaps this is an attractive option for terrorists. It would be attractive not only because of the economic damage that could be done, but because the actual attack requires considerably less expertise and less material and less technical skill and less in the way of sophisticated equipment or munitions than does attack on the human population.
The Germans tried this in World War I, didn't they, with anthrax and glanders? And
yeah, the Germans had a pretty ambitious program of trying to attack animals that were being assembled in neutral countries prior to shipping to the Allies. World War I was a war, even though it was a mechanized war. Tanks were invented then, for instance. Despite the mechanization of World War I, horses and mules were still quite valuable as means of drayage and also even as cavalry animals. Much of the Mesopotamian campaign, for instance, was fought on horseback. So among the other militarily important materiel that was being shipped from neutral trading partners to the Allies were animals. And so the Germans had campaigns in Romania, in the United States, which was neutral until 1917, in Argentina, in Spain, attacking horses and mules and possibly cattle that were being shipped to the Allies. They used the animal diseases, glanders and anthrax, either injecting them into the animals, putting them in their feed, spraying them into their nostrils. The effectiveness is not clear. One of the research projects that I have in the back burner is to try to go to the National Archives and look through the shipping records to see if I can establish any significant mortality during shipment of these animals. But at present, all we can really say is that there's no good evidence that the Germans achieved anything by this program.
The Japanese in the campaign against China actually did use human agents with some remarkable success.
Yes, the Japanese had a very ambitious program of anti-human biological warfare, as well as a program of biological warfare against plants and animals. It was considerably less sophisticated and, as far as we know, had relatively little effect. But the anti-human attacks were spectacularly successful in terms of communicating disease. They had essentially no impact on the course of the war, so they had really no strategic effect. But they did have a substantial impact on the Chinese people. The principal diseases were intestinal diseases like typhoid and cholera and plague. The Japanese had a facility in Manchuria, for instance, and they paid Chinese peasants to trap rodents for them, and they also had a breeding colony for rats, and they would then infect these rodents with plague and allow fleas to feed on the rodents, and then they would harvest the fleas and then load millions of fleas into airdrop tanks and then fly over Chinese cities and drop the fleas. Fleas, being very small and very light, can survive an airdrop with no problem, and they then would infect the rodents and the people in the city. It's been estimated that somewhere around 200,000 Chinese died in these kinds of attacks. And there were probably at least 10,000 deaths of prisoners of war that were used as human subjects for experiments in this program. As far as we know, the Japanese program was the only actual use of biological agents in World War II. There may have been some use by resistance fighters in Poland or France or the like of putting salmonella or other agents in German soldiers' coffee and things like that, but nothing particularly serious.
I guess after the war, the Americans and the Soviets were both very interested in this Japanese research and, in fact, agreed not to prosecute them for their data.
At the end of the war, the officers in charge of the Japanese program fled back to Japan, taking with them all of their cultures and their slides and their pathology reports and all of this material. The Soviet army, which was advancing south from Siberia into Manchuria, captured about 30 Japanese noncoms, but the senior brass got back to Japan. The Soviet Union put 30 or so Japanese officers and enlisted men that they had captured on trial in Khabarovsk, and all were convicted and given quite light sentences, actually. The Americans, who didn't at first understand that there had been such a substantial Japanese biological weapons program, did gradually, as top Japanese officers were interrogated during the occupation of Japan, they gradually began to suspect that there was something major there. And they then, with Truman's permission, MacArthur was allowed to offer a deal to these Japanese officers in which they were offered immunity from war crimes prosecution in exchange for sharing all of their information.
Well, why was that?
I think there's probably two principal reasons why this immunity deal was cut. I mean, certainly the Japanese were guilty of war crimes far in excess of what many German doctors were executed for. But the United States, I think, had two reasons for avoiding the prosecution. One was the obvious one, that the United States had, for several years at that point, had its own biological weapons program. We were not, because of the constraints in this country, we were not able to use human subjects, and we had not actually used biological weapons. So there was at least the potential that there was some very useful information in the Japanese experience. And it was thought, I presume, at that time, that the moral scruples against using that information were outweighed by the utility of it. The other main reason, I think, was simply that by the time the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal got underway, which was in 47, I believe, the Cold War was pretty well up and running, and the co-prosecutors in Tokyo were the United States, Australia, and Russia. And so any material that came out in the course of those war crimes tribunal trials of these Japanese officers would have to be shared with the Soviet Union, and I think the United States felt that was simply not acceptable.
In the post-war period, I guess these weapons were quite controversial on both sides of the Cold War.
After the Second World War, there were a number of allegations of the use of biological weapons. Probably the most politically important were allegations by North Korea and China against the United States for having used biological weapons in Korea, North Korea, and even in China over the North Korean border, being dropped by from airplanes. And in the early 50s, this was a major propaganda battle between the United States trying to defend itself, convince the world that it hadn't done this, and the Russians and the Chinese and the North Koreans alleging that they had. That ultimately died down, but there were, of course, other allegations. Cuba has accused the United States on several occasions of having introduced diseases into its territory. In retrospect, I think we can now say with some certainty that the U.S. clearly did not use biological warfare in North Korea. There is now documentary evidence that these allegations were outright fraudulent, and that the evidence that was presented to support them had been fabricated principally by the Chinese. The documentary evidence is still pretty sketchy, but we have several documents from mainly from Soviet sources that indicate that that's true and indicate that the Soviet Union knew that and was trying to actually dissuade the Chinese from pursuing this, but unsuccessfully.
Well, who had biological weapons in this time period?
Over the course of the 1950s and 1960s, a number of countries in the world accumulated major stockpiles of biological weapons. The Soviet Union was one of them. Probably the United States was the world's chief biological power in that time, and we had stockpiles of a number of nasty diseases loaded into munitions ready to be used. In 1969, President Nixon decided unilaterally to renounce all offensive biological weapons programs. He did so for a number of reasons, one of which was the recognition that the U.S. Stockpiles of these weapons legitimized them in a way, made it appear that these were useful weapons. And because biological weapons can be weapons of mass destruction, and they are technically considerably easier for a country to obtain than nuclear weapons.
The poor man's nuclear weapon, as it were.
Exactly. That's what they're often called. I think that's a bit misleading, but nevertheless, the basic fact is correct, that they can, at least under some conditions, give a country a weapon that can cause mass casualties. And to achieve a usable biological weapons capability requires considerably less in the way of scientific and technical infrastructure than does to achieve a nuclear capability. For this and probably other reasons, the military, for instance, has never really liked biological weapons. They seem sneaky, they seem underhanded, they're not very predictable. Right. So there's a variety of reasons why most military men have never particularly liked biological or chemical weapons. And it was also felt that we didn't need them for retaliatory purposes. If we were attacked with biological weapons, we had other options for retaliation: chemical weapons, nuclear weapons, or massive conventional weapons retaliation. So there seemed to be no reason to retain the stockpile, and Nixon renounced these weapons unilaterally and got, I think, rightly, considerable amount of recognition for taking the moral high ground. That renunciation then provided the stimulus for several countries, principally the United Kingdom, Russia, and the United States, to lead the way to a global ban on biological weapons, which was open for signature in 1972 and actually came into force as a treaty in 1975. It's called the Biological Weapons Convention.
You're listening to UC Davis microbiologist and bioterrorism expert, Dr. Mark Wheelis. Well, despite the U.S., the U.K., and the Soviet Union signing this weapons treaty in 1972, a lot of cheating went on.
Since that treaty came into force, and that treaty required that all parties to it completely abandon any efforts to develop, produce, or stockpile biological weapons, there are at least two major known violations of that treaty, and several additional less important ones. Probably the most important known violation was the Soviet Union. Even at the same time that it was one of the leaders of the international effort to develop this treaty, it was ramping up its own biological weapons program. And so from 1972, when the convention was developed, to sometime in the early 1990s, the exact chronology is still a little unclear, but at least during that period of time, the Soviet Union had a massive biological weapons program. It probably substantially surpassed the United States at its peak in the mid to late 60s. The reason for this is unclear, but it appears from a number of sources that the Soviet Union did not really believe that the United States was in fact renouncing biological weapons. I think they thought that the Nixon renunciation in 1969 was a public relations gesture, and that the bioweapons program was continuing in a covert way. And unfortunately, I think the United States contributed to that. There's at least one report, not confirmed yet, but it's at least one report that the United States was feeding misinformation to the Soviet Union through a series of double and triple agents. That misinformation was largely in the area of chemical weaponry. It has been asserted that one of the things we also were feeding to the Soviet Union was information that our renunciation of BW was in fact a sham, and we were continuing with it.
Now, why in God's name would they do that?
I don't know what the goal of such misinformation was. Apparently, at least for chemical weapons, it was to try to get the Soviets to waste a lot of time pursuing things that weren't really going to be useful. But in retrospect, it seems to me a horrible idea. With regard to chemical weapons, we actually encouraged through this deception, we encouraged the Soviets to pursue a new category of nerve gases, which we felt were not technically possible. But we now know that the Soviet Union did in fact develop a new generation of nerve gases as a result of these investigations. And to the extent that our misinformation about biological weapons was responsible for the Soviet program, it put us in tremendous jeopardy. We were very, very fortunate that they never used those weapons. But they still the expertise that was developed there is still there in Russia. The scientists who worked in the program are still alive, still active, and they still have the know-how that they developed under that program, and it represents a serious threat still to the United States security, I believe.
Which brings us to the present day. It's believed by many that this Soviet biological weapons program is the source, ultimately, for other states or groups being able to arm themselves, perhaps, with such weapons. And the question I would have that for you, which I'm not sure you can answer, is what's the true level of threat to the USA at the present time, vis-a-vis Iraq or Al-Qaeda or fanatical groups like the Aum Shinrinko, the ones that put the sarin gas in the Tokyo subway, or even the Rajneeshis with the little-known attack in the state of Oregon?
We now know of several terrorist attacks, terrorist uses of microorganisms as weapons. The Rajneeshis, as you mentioned, in the mid-80s attacked the town of the Dalles, county seat of Antelope County in southern Oregon, right in the Columbia Gorge, with salmonella. They infected a number of restaurants in the Dalles with salmonella and caused a documented 750 cases of salmonellosis, but there were probably many, many more. This is right on the Columbia River Scenic Highway, and many, many thousands of people go through the Dalles every day, and it's almost certain that the number of cases was much greater than actually reported. But the CDC was able to document at least 750 cases, 50 of them serious enough to require hospitalization. And it was, fortunately nobody died, but it was quite a serious outbreak. This was a pilot project to see if they would be able to later disrupt voting, because they had hopes of stacking the county commissioners to achieve some zoning changes that they were desirous of having. They never followed through on that, probably because they were scared off by the level of attention that the initial outbreak received. Although it was not identified by epidemiologists as a deliberate outbreak, despite, in retrospect, if you go back and read the epidemiology reports, it's pretty clear that it's awfully suspicious, lots of suspicious features to this outbreak.
What about the Aum Shinrikyo?
They are most famous for their sarin gas attack on the Tokyo subway, but they were also working on biological agents, both botulinum toxin, the protein toxin that's produced by the organism that causes botulism, highly lethal protein, and anthrax. They are alleged to have made at least 10 attempts to spread one or the other of these agents in among the Japanese public. Six attempts to spread botulinum toxin and four attempts to spread anthrax, with no success in either case. The reasons are probably trivial. They had the wrong strain of anthrax, for instance. They had an avirulent vaccine strain, and they may have had technical problems with their nozzles and the spray devices and things like that. Some people have taken from this that it would be very difficult for terrorists to really develop a true mass casualty anthrax weapon or botulinum toxin weapon, but I think that's probably pushing the data a bit farther than we can. We really are not sure. If given a little bit more time, they might have been able to develop a real weapon. And then finally, of course, the anthrax letter attacks of last fall, in which some unknown perpetrator was able to cause something on the order of 22. Perhaps a few more cases of anthrax, half of them cutaneous, half of them pulmonary, and kill five people. The perpetrator is still unidentified. Most people, including the FBI, feel that the perpetrator was probably an American, probably somebody who is a former or current employee either of the Defense Department biodefense program or of a private contractor that works with the biodefense program. But there are a significant number of people who still, significant minority I would say, but a significant number of people who still believe that we have been too hasty in dismissing Iraq as a possible source of these attacks.
I noticed in regard to some of the more extravagant claims being made about anthrax letters and other bioweapons that Ken Alibek, the Soviet weapons producer's name, seems to keep popping up.
Well, he's not the only one. And Ken Alibek, there's some former UN UNSCOM inspectors and the like who really see Iraq's fingerprints all over this. I don't think that Alibek has any special expertise in this area. He's probably largely responsible for what we know of the Soviet program from 1972 to the early 1990s. He defected in the 1990s, and he was one of two reasonably high-level defectors from the Soviet program. There was an earlier defector named Pasechnik to the UK. So it's largely due to Pasechnik and Alibek that we know about the Soviet program, and we know a fair amount about it. And so he's been very useful in that regard, and he's generally considered a highly credible source on the Soviet program. But there were no official links between the Soviet Union and the Iraqi program. I guess getting back to your earlier question, as far as I know, there is no evidence that the Soviet expertise has yet disseminated in any way that threatens the United States. There are some assertions that some of the people in Iraq or Syria or Libya or North Korea or Iran have ties to the Soviet program, but it's, to the best of my knowledge, hasn't been well documented. And I think in the case of Iraq, there's really no evidence. This was a homegrown program. The fact that a state like Iraq, which is sort of mid-level state in terms of technical sophistication, was able to develop a bioweapons program should give us some real pause. I don't think we can say at this point that it would be an effective program. We just don't know. We have a pretty good idea of the kinds of agents they had developed and were working on, the kinds of munitions they had, but we've never been given access to any of their testing data. We don't know much about how they tested these agents. We don't know whether they would actually work in combat. Unlike chemical agents, which Iraq used extensively against the Iranians in the Iran-Iraq War and developed a tremendous military experience with the use of those weapons, to the best of our knowledge, the Iraqis never have used their biological weapons, and so we really don't know whether they would work or not. But the fact that a state of the level of sophistication of Iraq was capable of developing a significant biological weapons capability suggests that there are lots of other states in the world that could if they decided they wanted to do so. And the fact that Iraq was able to do this largely undetected, not completely. We had an idea they were developing a bioweapons program, but at the beginning of the Gulf War, we had no idea of how far along they had gotten.
We're speaking with Dr. Mark Wheelis, UC Davis microbiologist, and we need to take a short break. We will continue this in our third segment. This is Radio Parallax, and you're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. I'm Douglas Everett.